it's a kind of irony that the more and more we get into it, there is a potential pitfall where you can get so focused on the specifics of nutrition and trying to dial it in even more and more and going super detailed on stuff that perhaps you're missing the bigger picture and doing things that are taking away from your overall health. And again, I mean that in the biggest sense of the world, not just physical health, that health, and this is something I've talked about on a podcast recently, is such a broad term that it's not just physical health. There's also, like, obviously psychological health, but there's all these other little factors that I would count as making someone a healthy human or not.
Hey guys, big announcement for today. We decided to take a summer break. That way, the Legendary Life team can spend some time with their loved ones and recharge. But also, we're going through a process where we are restructuring our business. We joined a coaching program. I've taken my own advice to hire a coach, and so excited. We're going to be creating the best content ever, and we're going to be launching that very soon. But in the next few weeks, what we're going to do is on Mondays, we're going to re-release our top downloaded episodes. On Fridays, of course, I love doing Fridays. I love doing the Real Talk episodes. So those will be new every single week. But this way, it's going to be great. We're restructuring everything and have the guidance that we needed to do so. So this is going to be a win for you, a win for us. So I want you to get ready for our best content ever. That's going to be released soon. We'll give you more notice about when those things happen. But until then, we're sending you our love, wishing you a great summer to spend with your loved ones, but also to relax, to de-stress, and to have some more me time so we can all live a legendary life. What is up, my friend, and welcome to the Legendary Life Podcast. I'm health expert Ted Rice, coach to entrepreneurs, executives, and other high-performing professionals. And what we do here at Legendary Life is break down science-based information on how to lose fat, prevent disease, and live a long, healthy, legendary life. So if that's what you're into, you are in the right place. Click that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts so that every time one of my episodes goes live, you'll be the first to know. Let's move on to the episode. I'm super excited to share with you this episode today because it's all about the other aspects of health that we tend to neglect. Yes, we focus on nutrition, on exercise, on sleep, but we tend not to talk about the things that affect our stress, like our depression, loneliness, social isolation. And we even know that these other aspects of health that are typically left out of the conversation when it comes to living a healthy life, that these things have been proven by science to increase inflammation. So even if you're exercising, even if you're eating well and sleeping right, if you've got these other things going on, you're never going to be as healthy as you could. You're not going to live as long as you could. So that's why I'm super excited to have my guest on today. His name is Danny Lennon. He's the host of the best science-based nutrition podcast on the planet. It's called Sigma Nutrition Radio. You've got to check it out if you've never listened to Danny's show before. And the other really cool thing is that I recorded this podcast in person with Danny in Chiang Mai, Thailand. So we got to sit down. It has such a different energy when you sit down with someone and just go back and forth and have a meaningful conversation. So I know you're going to love this one. By the way, if you resonate with this, please honor me by sharing this episode, because the more people who share, it's the biggest compliment you can give me for putting out content like this, for getting guests like Danny on. So please share this episode. And if you're new to the Legendary Life Podcast, make sure you click that subscribe button. And just to let you know what you're getting into, this show is all about upgrading your mind and your body. So if you're looking to make a breakthrough in your health and level up your life, you're in the right place for all the new listeners. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation with Danny Lennon. Danny Lennon, thanks so much for doing this, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on podcast. Yeah,
absolutely. And for those of you listening, we are sitting down in Chiang Mai We've known each other for several years, but we had the opportunity to meet in person, and we are deciding, or we sat down and decided to do this podcast.
Yeah, it's been great. And I think, as you probably know from other people you've met, it always adds something new when you get to meet someone in person and hang out and spend some time. And so, yeah, it's been awesome.
I've met some people in person, and I've been like, you are very different in person than your online persona. So it was really cool to meet you. And then, like, we had a great time. We went to the national park, the Doi Intanon National Park, and went hiking and swam in waterfalls and had fresh roasted coffee from that local area. And it was just an amazing time. And we got to hang out and have some great conversations as well.
Yeah. And that's the stuff that matters. So I'm glad that we're able to connect and do that and hang out. It was awesome.
Amazing. Well, what I think would serve people the best today is to jump into some of what you've been talking about a lot, which you are this expert, at least to me, in nutrition. And what I really like about your approach is you have a very objective approach, but also a very open approach. And so many people, say your contemporaries, right? The people who you end up speaking with, a lot of great people. But I think also they're not, at least in my experience of them, as open-minded as you. In fact, I learned quite a few things speaking with you on our van ride back from the national park the other day. So let's get into a little bit about what you're into about, like, let's talk about nutrition, people's focus on nutrition, and why maybe that isn't the best focus if they're wanting optimal health. Because what I say is that when you get your body fat handled, what else is there? There are some things, right?
You
can look at your blood, your blood biomarkers, various biomarkers, and make sure that what you're doing is supporting what we know to be optimal, keeping those biomarkers in the optimal range. And there's some functional foods, right? If you're, or whatever you term you want to use, but there's foods that can have specific effects, like spirulina on allergies or citrulline on blood flow, right? But take it away.
Sure. So a few things that I think of when this kind of topic comes up. I think one common flow that I think happens quite a bit is when most of us get interested in nutrition in the first place, it's for a specific other reason other than just learning about food, right? It's that we either want to improve our health, or other people may get into it because they want to improve their athletic performance. Some people may want to change their body composition. They're the three kind of primary goals, but a lot of it is driven around being healthier in the grandest sense of the word, right? And so it's a kind of irony that the more and more we get into it, there is a potential pitfall where you can get so focused on the specifics of nutrition and trying to dial it in even more and more and going super detailed on stuff that perhaps you're missing the bigger picture and doing things that are taking away from your overall health. And again, I mean that in the biggest sense of the world, not just physical health, that health, and this is something I've talked about on a podcast recently, is such a broad term that it's not just physical health. There's also, like, obviously psychological health, but there's all these other little factors that I would count as making someone a healthy human or not. So for example, you can be in perfect physical health and you could, let's say, feel that you're doing okay in most senses, but let's say all the relationships around you are gone to shit, right? You've alienated yourself from your friends. Your colleagues think you're a piece of shit. You have fallen out with your family and you're not talking to anyone because of whatever. If that's the case, can you say this person is truly as healthy a person as they could be? No, right? There's ways to become healthier. And so this all goes to speak to, if you are doing certain things with your nutrition or your training or whatever goals you have that in isolation may look like a good thing, but are detracting from other areas where you can be healthy, that could be problematic, right? So if you get so focused on what you eat and what you look like to the point where you can no longer go and share a meal with family and friends, or you can no longer eat at specific times where they're most likely to be socializing.
Like of that could be hashtag intermittent fasting.
There's loads of examples, right? So like yeah. I'm actually quite fond of some of the like time restricted feeding literature, and maybe partitioning more of our energy intake to earlier in the day, maybe not eating so big late at night as a general rule. However, there's that kind of, again, that point where you can take that too far to say, I can never eat after 5 p.m. And well, guess what? Most social occasions where people are going to be hanging out around food or beer or just a general party is going to be happening at those times. The same thing with your sleep. I'm super big on sleep, but there's times where people are going to have stuff going on where maybe you're going to have to stay up late. And there's some other benefits to that that may acutely affect you think your health negatively, but in the long term are a bigger picture. And there's loads of examples we could get into, but that just, that kind of comes back to your original point of, yes, nutrition is super important for health and it can be very beneficial if we get it right. But realize that there's lots of things that influence your health. And if you're doing a certain behavior that detracts from some of those, then the net benefit or the net effect may not be a benefit and may become a negative.
Yeah. And I want to dive into that more. I would like to hear, like I said at the beginning, that the number one thing you can do is just maintain a healthy body fat percentage. Mm-hmm. What's your view on nutrition with all your expertise? How do you look at what we can achieve with nutrition by focusing on it so intently?
Sure. So I guess in the Western world, at least, we're not in the main problem with nutrition of like getting enough energy, right? So we're not in a place where we can't get access to enough calories. And similarly, it's most nutrient deficiencies, like true deficiencies, are not going to be a major problem because of the amount of food that we have access to. Now, of course, many people may not be getting enough of certain micronutrients because their diet is pretty poor quality and so on, which is something we can circle back to. But in general, they're not big. Malnutrition is not as big a concern in the Western world, right? So then you think of, well, what are the potential downsides? One, like you said, is body composition. We know while it's not a direct linear relationship between, say, adiposity and your health outcomes, because you can have someone of a higher level of body fat that may end up with no chronic disease or metabolic dysfunction. Similarly, you can have someone that has a low amount of body fat, but that can become very unhealthy and develop certain chronic diseases. So it's not a linear relationship, but in general, if we look at a population of people, it's quite clear that if you have a very high level of adiposity, you have an increased risk of certain chronic diseases, particularly metabolic diseases like, say, type 2 diabetes. And so having that within a lower range may be beneficial for that. Beyond that, I think we can then look at micronutrient intake is kind of is separate from just body composition. So you can have someone who's a lean individual, but again, poor quality diet means they're not getting enough micronutrients. You could look at...
You mean the people who are doing keto, who just eat bacon, butter, and, you know, a little bit of some iceberg lettuce? Yes.
Pick any type of diet and there's a way to do it terribly, right? Same thing. Right? You could do a vegan diet, but only eat processed junk foods, but that doesn't contain any animal products. Same thing with the keto example you just gave. Same with any type of diet, the types of foods you include will impact, say, micronutrients. Similarly, it will impact how much fiber someone is getting, particularly soluble fiber in their diet. So if you're eating a diet that keeps you within good body composition, but you eat a lot of protein, but almost no fiber in your diet, that can be poor for like digestive health, colon health. It can increase risk of things like colon cancer potentially. So there are other things that we have known are well established, micronutrients like the polyphenols in vegetables, fiber intake, all the stuff we kind of know about that have very real health impacts beyond body composition. And then there's probably another layer that we could get into is just there's aspects to eating and food that are separated from their nutritional content, right? So the environment you eat your food in, the mindset you're in. So by that, I mean, if you are eating and like you are just grabbing a sandwich on the go as you're rushing down the street to go to a meeting, that'll have a very different effect potentially than having a meal where you're sitting down with friends and family, joking, and you take your time over a meal and there's a social element to it. And that's one of the kind of confounding things with something like the Mediterranean diet. You've seen a lot of those populations. It's not just about the food choices.
Right.
It's also about the social component. So the time they take over the meals, it's a thing that brings people together, and there's a sense of relaxation as they're having those kind of meals. So there's those. And then there's also another psychological factor of the enjoyment that we derive from food. Right. So that can be like good food is one of the most pleasurable things that we can find, right?
Sure.
Proper good food experiences. And I don't just mean like hyper palatable, like sugary foods. I mean like proper good food that we really enjoyed that meal. Like that's one of the great things about life.
Like the Thai restaurant I took you to.
Precisely. That's one of the great things. It's why people love travel so much. What's one of the big things that people do when they travel? They want to see the local cuisine cooked in a certain way that's always been done, these certain types of flavors. And those experiences add something that is very hard to quantify. Like, how does that fit into how healthy we are? Well, it's impossible to quantify, but it's an important part of life. And so that's one example of we can't just dismiss all that because we want to have a certain type of body composition. So there's lots of elements that we could explore, but so nutrition and food can impact our health in many ways that are completely separate from body composition. And as an aside, this is perhaps why having a direct focus on body composition all the time or body weight can be problematic for people, because if they aren't making progress in the area, they feel, well, I'm failing. What's the point of me even trying to do this stuff? Instead of saying, well, even if I forget about my weight for a moment, it doesn't matter if it's changing or not, I can still choose to eat generally healthier foods, approach my nutrition in a healthier way that will still benefit my health even before I'm able to lose weight or even if I don't lose weight. And so that's important for people to bear in mind that there's a lot more beyond body composition.
Yeah, no, that's really important. And a good message for me too, sometimes I harp on the body fat thing without taking into consideration all these other things that you're mentioning. Danny, I want to shift into kind of the dark side of nutrition philosophy, if you will. So one of the things that you and I have talked about is just now, for example, the other parts of nutrition, spending time with people. Mm. And what we're finding online, what I'm finding and getting attacked about just recently, just people seem to use nutrition as their religion, as their group that they belong to.
Right.
And so they'll get some results with maybe becoming a vegetarian or vegan or keto or doing intermittent fasting. And so that experience leads to success, probably creates some sort of thing in the brain, a chemical situation in the brain, probably spikes dopamine when they get a success, then they meet others and it starts to become like, oh yeah, you did intermittent fasting and you lost weight. Oh, I did intermittent fasting is the way, or keto is the way, or vegetarianism or veganism or whatever, Atkins is the way. Then they start gathering in groups and they take on almost a life of their own,
right?
Where they're, I don't know how much time these people are spending with each other outside of their Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts, but people are finding that group connection, that group belonging in nutrition. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that, and also how there's also a positive side to that, but maybe we can be more intentional about how we go about it instead of being sucked up in the vortex of groupthink and toxic tribalism.
Sure. It's a very understandable thing of why it happens. So I think when you think about human beings and the way we are kind of set up or programmed to think, we tend to be quite tribalistic, right? We tend to fall within certain tribes for many different reasons that we could probably date back to evolutionary biology, that feeling belonging to a certain group or a certain tribe can give us benefits, right? There's safety, there's people that have similar views to us. We feel that here's now people that get me, they've had similar life experiences. And in many cases, that can be quite beneficial. It's the reason why, for example, support groups can have benefit, right? People have gone through similar experiences. You feel you can connect with them and you feel like you belong here. It's why one of the good things about the, say, internet forums and groups is that you can have people that may be in like small rural communities that have this very niche interest that in decades gone by, they would have had no one else interested in that, would have felt like an outsider. Now they can be in these forums with other thousands of people from around the world that have this very specific thing they're into. So it can give people a sense of belonging. And the same thing is going to happen with nutrition because everyone eats and everyone is going to have some sort of dietary pattern. And some people potentially are going to seek that out more. The other aspect of why that also happens is thinking rationally and thinking scientifically are inherently non-human.
Yeah.
They're not how humans are set up to think. The whole idea of the scientific method and science is how can we objectively view the world and make decisions by taking the human element out of it as much as possible. It's why we try and control variables. We use blinded trials. All this type of randomization, everything we can use is a way to take human judgment and error out of what we're seeing. Because when we observe something, we can think we know why that happens, but we could be lying to ourselves subconsciously. So science tries to work out, well, what is really causing this thing to happen? What is the causal relationship between things? And so our mind isn't set up that way. It's not scientific. And it's more based at the same thing, rationality. It's trying to say everyone thinks they're rational.
Sure.
And we can try and be more rational in our decision-making. But even then, a lot of the time, it's not necessarily 100% complete rationality. A lot of the times, it's actually, we still make decisions for emotional reasons. And then afterwards, we just use rationality to explain why we did it, when it's probably not really the case. And this happens to everyone, even if you're aware of it happening. I think a lot of Danny Kahneman's stuff is kind of based on this as well. It's a great book, Thinking Fast and Slow, if people want to read that. But so inherently, how people think is more based in kind of emotion than clear logic and rationality. And there are things that have to be learned. And the same with critical thinking and scientific thinking, there are skills that have to be learned. So it's easy to see why people would emotionally connect with they had a beneficial experience on a diet. It transformed their life. And now, of course, they're going to have some sort of pull towards that. Now they're going to seek out other people that have done that. And they get the same kind of backup of those ideas that people are reporting the same thing. So they feel great. And it almost creates this cycle of reinforcing those beliefs. And then the kind of third element is where it probably gets a bit more problematic is when it becomes wrapped up in their identity.
Right.
And so as my friend Kieran puts it, he wrote a piece that's actually on the site where he talked about the difference between people having a belief versus identifying themselves as a certain belief. And the same thing goes here with diet. Rather than saying, yeah, generally I eat a diet that is a ketogenic diet. That's one way to look at it. If you now say, I am keto, and then you're kind of within that group, that's now kind of giving yourself an identity based on a certain type of dietary pattern, as opposed to, I just eat these types of foods most often. And the same thing tends to happen if you see any type of dietary group, I am paleo or I'm vegan or I'm carnivore, whatever it is. For certain people, that becomes a core part of their whole identity. And so then it's very difficult to rationally pick apart stuff that may be problematic with it because it's going against your identity.
Who
it's going
you
against
are,
these,
yeah.
Right? These people that have supported you, that have the same beliefs. And that's why it gets very difficult. And so, yeah, it's all based on that kind of tribal environment, wrapping it within your identity. And to a certain point, then it becomes difficult to be able to see when critiques of that are valid. Because instead, people take that personally. And I'm sure you've seen this online, right? You might say, hey, that's awesome that you've had this success in this diet, but The reason why this happened may not be down to you eliminating this specific type of food. It's probably that this changed your behavior and your overall caloric intake changed. Instead of them thinking through that rationally and saying, well, that's a good kind of critique, and realizing you're not saying the diet is bad,
right,
or the diet doesn't work. You're just saying, here's a mechanistic reason. They think what they're hearing is, oh, you're saying this diet is idiotic. It doesn't work. Well, I know it works because I lost X amount of weight.
You're attacking my identity.
Right. And yeah. What you're really not saying that it doesn't work. And because I get this, I've seen this a lot of the time. Like I know ketogenic diets work. I know low carb diets work. I know vegan diets can work. So that's not really the question we're getting at. It's for a certain person. Why do they work? What were the underlying reasons? But it's difficult if you feel belong to this tribe, you feel like almost you have to defend it. And that's not everyone. That's still a minority of people who are in those different communities, but they're just a vocal minority. So that's why it gets amplified online, right? But most people probably are going to be okay, but it's easy to see how they slip into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's obviously benefits, right? We talked about the community last time. When I was on your show, we talked about social isolation, loneliness, how it's toxic on the cellular level, increases inflammation, right? Decreases your immune system function. But I think the issues here, and it's great to be part of a group. It's just when it starts taking away your time and energy, right? Mm-hmm. We have limited time in a day. There's an opportunity cost to everything that we do. So for arguing online with people,
right,
or just spending time reading something, getting triggered, maybe not even actively participating in it, but reading a back and forth or reading all the comments or reading articles, it's taking away from things that we could be doing, right? If we choose to do something, that means we're saying no to every other thing while we're doing that activity. And so are you getting a return on your investment, right?
Right.
Are you getting relaxation or something out of it? And what it seems to be, of course, you know, it's hard to quantify this. Like you said, it's the vocal minority and we're not sure exactly what's happening with people, but it's like, is that the best use of your time? And even if you want to belong to a group, are you meeting with people in person, right? Are you out there living your life and actually experiencing the benefits? I'm not sure if any of the research has been done, but I'm guessing that having social groups online, while it's probably, like you mentioned, better than being isolated in some part of town where you never feel like you can connect with anyone because you have over some interest you have, some hobby that you have, and now you can find it online. But what about, you know, does that really replace connecting with people? Mm. Like one of the things that's awesome, you and I, we met, right? And we both kind of pushed to make it happen. Mm. So we used the online medium as a way to connect in real life.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And went in disconnected from the world and hiked out in the national park. And what my point is that I want people to kind of be aware of, like, just more aware of why they're doing things and more importantly, the benefit that they're getting from it.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I'm certainly not an expert in this area, and it would be interesting to see data on it. But I would hypothesize that, like you said, there can be a clear benefit if you go in the direction of, you have these maybe online groups, maybe that leads to maybe meeting some of those people in person, or even if you don't meet those specific people, the things you learn online in certain groups, right? And the things you get interested in, and that may translate to you getting involved in local groups that are interested in the same topic, or let's say you start getting interest in fitness and you start learning about in these online forums. And then you maybe go to some meetups or start in a certain gym and you start training some, or whatever it is that translates something into real life that can be really beneficial. There's obviously the opposite that can happen, which I think is what you're kind of alluding to, of people who use these online forums that actually detract away from their their everyday life of situations where they would otherwise have to be going out. And so they're actually actively avoiding social situations because they want to spend more time online in these like created digital social situations. And I'm not sure if it happens that people do that and then it creates problems, or if the reason why they do it is because of something deeper. And I would guess that's the case of if you take someone who maybe is suffering with anxiety or depression or is socially insecure in some way, it would make sense that one of the things you would want to do is retreat away from those social situations. And then you can surround yourself in an online world because you're to some degree safe in it, in your own room, right? And so what the internet now allows people to do is to do more of that, right? They can completely isolate themselves, but still be interacting
social,
and stuff,
right? Quote unquote, social.
Yeah. And it's so, I don't know what way around it happens, but it definitely would make sense that if there's the option there that you can retreat back into it. And of course, people would do that anyway if there wasn't internet. If someone is suffering with depression, of course, there's going to be a likelihood that they're going to be spending time alone and purposely isolating themselves from others. That's kind of one of the key things that happens often. But that may be part of it too, that just because you are spending times in these groups doesn't necessarily mean it's of the same quality. And that probably speaks to when you mention loneliness and social isolation, they kind of get used a bit interchangeably, but the kind of slight nuance that makes a difference here in that loneliness is that kind of feeling of being alone. Whereas like social isolation is you can quantify the number of relationships in that person's social network, and you can quantify the number of interactions they have, for example.
Sure. So that's an important distinction.
Yeah. Because that means that someone can have social interactions and so maybe not be socially isolated, but can still feel lonely.
Right.
Right. It's why people can feel lonely in a city of millions of people and they interact with people, but it's the quality and depth of those relationships make them feel lonely. And then vice versa, people may not feel lonely at all, but could be socially isolated. And so it could be certain types of people just don't mind spending time alone and find it easy to isolate themselves away from others, or maybe a situation forces that they've lost certain relationships around them, but maybe they don't feel as alone as someone else. So that could be an example here that you could have people that are, yeah, sure, they're interacting with others in these groups, but if the depth and quality of those relationships is pretty poor because it's as hard to do it online as it is in person, maybe they have greater feelings of loneliness despite those number of online interactions.
Yeah, important point. And one thing that I've gotten more interested in, concerned about, passionate about is something that I realized kind of early in my career, actually, as a personal trainer. Now I just do online coaching work and some work in person with VIP situations, but I saw that there was a diminishing returns on working out, on losing body fat. And you saw like people were struggling. I saw my clients were struggling. And these were successful people. I worked in Miami Beach in the hottest gym in town at the time. Mm. And these people were really struggling with all types of issues, some relationships, some substance issues, some depression, some just a lack of purpose with what they were doing, right? I trained a criminal defense attorney who was just had to be medicated. He got so depressed, right? I worked with another attorney, just totally miserable dude, but he was taking cases that were 20 million and above, right? And so one thing that I really enjoyed our conversation that we had on the other, coming back from the park, was that you were talking about purpose and how important purpose is. Mm. And it's one of these things where if you're a person listening and you're not exercising, not stepping up with eating better, that's really easy to start with those things and sleep and get an improvement in the way you feel, in the way that you function. But what happens when you're already kind of doing well in that area and to exercise, to optimize your program, you're not going to get a big return on that. You're going to have to turn to something else.
Yeah.
And we talked about purpose and Johann Hari. Could you talk a little bit about that? I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. I'll maybe take a step back and talk about in general why that comes up, at least to me, is that
sure.
First, the idea that people who need to, maybe who are, let's say, in poor health or who are overweight or living with obesity, that it's just all about personal responsibility, right? It's just like, oh, just start eating better and exercising and take care of yourself. Sometimes maybe that's something that some people need to hear, but oftentimes that's not necessarily the case. And because a lot of times the reasons driving that is that there's something deeper going on that is preventing those types of behaviors. And it's not a lack of knowledge of knowing what good food is. And as I think I mentioned to you when we were chatting before, if someone goes through, let's say, a serious trauma or something major going on in their life, it's kind of really difficult to even think or care about what type of food you're eating, right? So if that happens acutely, then if we think in a chronic sense, if someone is, again, like those clients you mentioned, have depression or have certain life circumstances that are really difficult, without addressing some of those, it's going to be difficult to consistently think about what do I need to do with my training and nutrition to optimize that, right? It's the reason why we see that obesity rates are vastly different between those in a low socioeconomic class and those that have a higher one, right? That's just across the board, pretty predictive that you see most of the time in general. And again, that's not down to we need to educate these people more on what good food is, that there's other reasons that they're of what their day-to-day life and what the social situation they find themselves in is going to trump their ability to be able to either get access to good food or even to be making those decisions or even care about that, right? Because there's all this other stuff going on. And so that's the kind of first point I would say. There's all these other things, whether that's your environment around you, the situation you find yourself in life right now, whether it's a trauma you're dealing with, all these things that are going to supersede trying just to optimize nutrition, for example, right? So one of those, if we kind of drill down into different distinct classes, one of those would be purpose. And that's one way to term it. And I've actually recently recorded a podcast where I kind of talked about my definition for health and this kind of framework of different aspects that relate to what is health. And one of the kind of subtopics in that was purpose. And different people will use a different word or maybe define it a different way. And to some degree, people might find it cliche that it's like, follow your passion and just do that. And that's not really what I mean with purpose. And this gets to the example that you brought up of Johann Hari, who has written a couple of books. He's wrote one on addiction and one on depression. And in one of the podcast interviews, I think it was the one he did with Joe Rogan, he talked about work-related depression. And one of the points he made was that it's often not driven by the specific job someone is. So when you try and look for patterns, you don't see people that do this work become depressed and people who have this work don't. And so if someone could have objectively on paper what a high-paying job or a high-status job, maybe an attorney, like the example you give, that doesn't mean they don't become depressed. In fact, a lot of them can. And similarly, you could have someone who's on a minimum wage job that conventionally people might not look as a high-status job, but they get certain things from that work that doesn't lead to this work-related depression. And so one of the components that relates there was autonomy in the work that you do. So if you feel you have some control over either the type of work you're doing or at least the way you get to go about it or the way you organize your kind of work day or the things you're trying to do, that's going to be a lot better for you psychologically than feeling that every single thing that you do is lined out for you already and is controlled in a very specific way, and you're not really contributing anything to that process, right? So one of the examples he gave was a guy he met, I can't remember, I think it was a guy that somewhere in Illinois who worked in this place where his job, he wasn't allowed to do anything apart from people. It was like a hardware store, but people would bring up a chart and show him the type of paint they wanted. And he wasn't allowed like give any advice or do any of the mixing. So it was like, he would take a certain paint thing, put it in a machine, it would mix it around, it would give it back out, and he would hand it to them.
Right.
Right. And he wasn't given any other autonomy in that. And there was probably other things going on, but he ended up like hating that kind of work he did. And that led on to other things and this kind of work-related depression. But autonomy is one piece. And the other that kind of relates to that is the control you feel from, say, your boss. If you feel like they're controlling in a very, let's say, condescending type of way, that they look down on you, don't treat you right, that is obviously going to be very different than if you have someone who doesn't. And that ties into autonomy in general. And then obviously the work environment, the people you work with, if there's just hatred between the workers, that's going to be very different than others. But where this ties into purpose is some of the stuff around autonomy, but just that, not that you need this big purpose that you're changing the world, but just that something that you're doing is contributing in some particular way to that type of work. So again, the job becomes irrelevant. It could be any type of job. If you can find a way to cultivate purpose of this means something to be doing this, and my contribution to at least the team of workers that is in this particular office or this room or this factory, my role means something and I'm contributing something, that is more powerful than not having that and feeling like you're completely replaceable. It doesn't matter what you're doing. No one really cares. People look down on you.
Cog in the machine.
Right. And so that's one aspect of the kind of purpose with work. But when I think of purpose, I also think of it broader than just work, in that people can find deep purpose in their life that's unrelated to it. So they could find maybe work they're not all that fond of, and maybe they don't like their job. But let's say they have found a new partner that they just have fallen in love with, and now see, this is someone I want to be able to provide a certain type of life for, and I'm super happy. And they now see that job as a ways to get to that end purpose of this life they want to live. Yeah. Or the same, you see a lot when people have start a family, for example, a kid might give them that purpose as well, right? That becomes their sole driver of the type of work they're doing and why they want to work hard. So now the type of work doesn't matter as much because they see a point to it and a purpose of what their life's about. Beyond family, it could be hobbies that we get into. How many people get involved in a sport that rationally, when you look at it, is like, I'm spending way too much time and effort and on this particular thing. I'm not a professional athlete. I don't get any money from it. In fact, it costs me money, but it gives people some degree of purpose to be involved in that type of sporting endeavor or whatever hobby it is. So there's all different ways for them to cultivate that purpose from your work, from your relationships, from the activities and hobbies you get involved with. And so maybe you could pay attention to all of them or try and get something from somewhere, but a general feeling of that you have something to work towards, right? You have something to try and get better at. And so it can be any type of, whether that's a relationship that you're trying to be a better partner, or whether it could be a certain type of skill, like we mentioned, that I'm trying to get better at this thing, or I'm trying to build this specific type of business. It doesn't matter then if it's hard to do and it's difficult, because you see that you're on this process of trying to get better at something, and that becomes the purpose, right? It's the old cliche of that journey is more important than destination, because it's the same thing. It's just trying to progressively get better at something. And it's when you don't have that, like if you're in a job where there is no progression, you don't have to get better. It doesn't matter if you do a good or a bad job, no one cares and you don't care.
Right.
And then you don't feel like that's providing any value in other areas of your life, you're not going to be happy doing that. And so it's trying to find how putting effort into something, why does it matter? So if you just find a reason that it matters to get better at something or to put effort into it, there's some outcome, then that's probably going to be better.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant, Danny, and so important. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about Mihai Csikszentmihalyi with the book Flow, kind of coined the term. And it's kind of been taken to where flow states are all about doing something dangerous and exciting and crazy and jumping out of airplanes or doing helicopter skiing and that type of thing or doing martial arts. But one of the examples that a lot of people miss from his work is that there was a story about a woman who baked bread for her community. And I forget where it was, but she was a baker, but she felt a tremendous sense of purpose. She was so happy. And to bring it even more to what you and I are experiencing day to day in Thailand is a lot of people have their own businesses here. They don't make that much money. The average income is $10 a day or 300 baht, right? In the local currency. But you see, of course, we're not having deep conversations with these people, but just the interaction with some people, they have a cart on the side of the road and they spend so much time and energy in making their little intricate desserts and selling them for a dollar.
Right.
USD, and they're so happy and so into it and take such great pride into it. And contrast that with if you go to Miami, where I was born and raised, and a lot of the places I've traveled to in the US, people are just not feeling that way at all. It's very hard to get the reaction from people that you get here. And obviously there's other aspects to it, cultural aspects, right? This is a Buddhist majority country. 96 or more percent of the population is into Buddhism. A lot of the men have become monks for a little while. And but you see, that's just something that's stood out to me. Has that affected you since you've been here? You've been traveling around Asia as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think there's probably plenty of examples that different people give of how those things impact us and kind of given some of the stuff that we've talked about before and even today of, well, what things are going on? A lot of the time it's kind of small community-based stuff. A lot of it's kind of family-run. It's, you look at particularly a lot of the food stalls that you mentioned are, that's where most people come out to eat, right? A lot of them don't eat at home. So it's a very community of like people are going to gather here and spend time. And I think so it's providing other things apart from just the kind of financial aspect to it. And like you say, if you can find purpose in, no matter what you're doing, you want to do it as best as you can, that in of itself is a kind of some degree of a purpose. And I think another example was, I can't remember where I heard it, and I forget which country it is. It's one of the Asian countries, but I can't remember if it's Japan or Korea or somewhere within Asia, where the example they gave was guys who collect the garbage or bin men, rubbish men, whatever country you're in, you'll have a different term for it. But the guys that go and collect garbage by the side of the road, in this particular culture, that was actually seen as that they were treated with great respect. Because within the community, the culture had learned that these people are doing a really important service for this community, particularly when you think of how easy in certain places is for like disease to spread in like hot countries if like rubbish is uncollected.
Yeah.
But people are seeing that this is something that is a selfless service for this particular community. This is a big thing. And so they had like this great respect around them. So just this different way of viewing things completely shapes the actual type of work that you're doing. So objectively, the work is the same as if you were doing that in the States or in the UK or whatever, but the perception that you may feel or certainly that other people around you give is different because of some of that cultural stuff. So yeah, definitely different cultures have a different way of viewing things. And there's probably a lot to be learned because I mean, just even if you're going on a broad observational kind of just associational level, that the countries that are the richest and wealthiest countries in the world have the highest rates of depression, suicide, et cetera. And that says something is going on that's outside of just financially what you're making in a certain job, right?
Yeah, no, that's so important. Yeah, especially with the States. I don't know about stats elsewhere, but anxiety is the leading health issue. Depression's on the rise. Suicide's on the rise. In 2017, more people died from drug overdoses in the U.S. than any other year before it.
Right.
And it's this stuff that the deeper stuff where it's not maybe as fun as talking about, okay, Danny, so what's the best supplement to take?
Right.
But it's the talks that need to happen. I'm curious, how do you view like the shifting of focus in the health and fitness industry? Where do you think we're going to with all this, all these other topics being brought up and popularized, and how that's going to affect how people like us in the health and fitness industry help people?
Mm, that's interesting. I think it depends on you, because to a certain degree, there are different pockets around the health and fitness industry that maybe not get exposed to each other. And so it depends where people end up looking. And I'm sure there's a lot of the stuff that's going on that I've no clue about or is being the way it's always been done. But I think certainly areas that I've been trying to look into that I've been maybe trying to bring more attention to through conversation, or that I'm trying to learn more about, that I'm starting to see seep a bit more into fitness. I'll mention a couple. So one that's particularly top of mind right now is there's a whole area of literature based on non-dieting approaches. And so this would, under that umbrella, would come things like health at every size, which people may have heard. It's acronym HAES or HAES. So the essentially that model being that people can be, we shouldn't focus on body weight and body composition change in counseling people around health improvement, and instead focus on health promoting behaviors. And while some of that is at odds with some conclusions that I would have, and I would have some disagreement with some of it. So for example, they're saying like never make body weight or adiposity a target of the intervention you're going to use with training and nutrition, for example. And the rationale behind this whole movement is one, that we have this kind of weight stigma within society, right? If you are overweight or you have obesity, there is a lot of stigma against people within, and you can look at different areas of just how they feel that people treat them, maybe how they feel they're impacted by in job interviews, maybe how they are portrayed online or on TV shows, or how people talk to them, the type of language they use them, a lot of ways that people can feel bad about themselves based on body weight and body shape and size and all this negative body image that stuff that comes with it. And so it's trying to acknowledge there is this potential weight stigma that can happen. And second to that, if you think of the typical advice that's often being given, if someone is, let's say, has obesity and goes to a doctor, it's like, okay, you need to lose weight, you need to eat less, start doing some exercise, and let's get your weight down because that is important for your health. And when you look at, in general, when most people do that, they're not successful long-term. They either lose some weight and gain it back or don't do it at all.
And 95% of the time or 80% or some terrible.
Yeah. So if you take that, again, because most people aren't going to go and sign up with one trainer who really knows his stuff, is going to take care of all the lifestyle stuff, nutrition, training, really help them accountability through it. Most people that are going to try and diet, not, like you say, probably 95% will gain that weight back or more. So knowing that we have such a high failure rate, and knowing people are made to feel bad for being overweight or have obesity, then it goes to their kind of point is, well, now we're just creating this cycle of people feeling like a failure because they haven't lost weight. And then the only solution they're being offered is you need to go and diet to lose weight. They try and diet and then they're more than likely going to fail. And then this kind of circle begets itself, instead of their approach being, well, instead of making that the whole focus or even any focus of what we're trying to do, instead of talking to people about dieting or weight loss or restriction, we can talk to these people of, even if you are in a larger body, you can still focus on these health promoting behaviors. You can still try and find some activity that you enjoy doing. You can still eat kind of healthy foods. You can try and get better quality sleep. You can follow health promoting behaviors, but just don't have weight or body appearance as a kind of goal. So the reason why I bring this up is, like I said, there's certain parts of that framework and approach that I would probably disagree with. But I think there's also intrinsic value in some of those points because they're actually good points. And so what I'm trying to do is think of, well, what way can coaches, practitioners, other people interested in improving people's health take on board some of this and maybe integrate that into what we're doing? Is there a case where certain types of people that you work with would be better way being moved away from thinking about body weight? Almost certainly, particularly if people have body image issues or histories of eating disorders and so on.
The scale.
Right.
Right.
There's lots of value in moving
scale
away.
Scale is my enemy.
Using it. Right.
What I've heard mostly women
right.
say.
Yeah. And it certainly happens. So it's trying to find, okay, here's a new perspective on stuff that hasn't been typically within health and fitness, right? There's, and still very much so it's, and for probably good reason, you could say people are still focused on trying to help people change their body composition because that's what people actually want. That's what they come to them for. And as we've mentioned earlier, your body composition does have clear associations with long-term health risk. But there's kind of this side that maybe now can start to be used more within those circles where coaches can have an ability to use tools that are not focused on tracking food intake, not weighing yourself, not looking at fat loss as the only metric that someone is aiming for, and instead have this, I suppose, compassionate lens to view things through that may benefit certain people. And so that's one example that I can think of. There's probably others, but I'll leave there because I've been talking quite a while.
What about biohacking, Danny? Yeah. That's a great, I really like that a lot. And I've had to, with my own clients, I've had to, if I give them what a lot of them sign up with me for, which is, okay, here's this personalized nutrition, personalized exercise routine. But if they're not able to follow it and it's like, it's just not happening. Mm. We need to reevaluate the approach because beating them over the head or telling them to woman up or man up, it's a really, I hate that strategy. Mm. It's just so, you know, besides the fact that it just doesn't work, it's just not getting the result. It's not helping the person.
Right. It's almost lazy to the degree of
it's
not
lazy.
Looking of
yeah.
what's causing them not to be able to do it, right?
Exactly.
So instead of looking for that, I'll just tell them, you need to kind of try harder.
Listen,
right?
I've done my job. You do your job.
Right. So that's certainly a thing. And so I don't think, so the thing I take from some of this approach that rather than, oh, I'm not going to counsel people on weight loss anymore or worry about that, like, because that's most of our coaching still does. I should probably make that clear that if people come to change your body composition, our still coaching is aimed at helping them do that, right? And there's different ways beside tracking their food that we can do that, or we don't have to measure their body weight. For some people, we will a lot of the time. There's different ways to do it. But still, if someone's coming with that goal, we don't say no, whereas the health at every size approach would be against that completely. You don't counsel to change weight. So our coaching philosophy is very different to that. And so I haven't bought in completely to it. But some of the aspects that I think are useful is realizing that some people, number one, respond to that. But beyond that is just being more aware of the language we use and how that can potentially affect others. And if it's an easy change to make, then that should be quite straightforward. So one of the things that have come from medical literature and it's been something I've been trying to work on because it doesn't come naturally because of how I've been trained, let's say, and educated is, for example, rather than using the term obese person, you would say person with obesity.
Person with obesity.
Right.
Okay.
And so it's a subtle change, but it's for me, because this is only something recent over the last year or so that has started to emerge as something that within medical organizations like the NHS have tried to talk about and that I've been even aware of is that most research that I read will still use the term obese person, right? Most medical textbooks and so on. So it's not anything purposely or with intent that people are saying this. But if I learn that some people will find that phrasing more difficult to deal with, then sure, I can try and work on changing it. I still don't get it right all the time. And I'm sure on the podcast,
you're saying the medical literature is saying that the using these terms affects people.
Yeah. So it can tie into
our language.
Yeah. The way our language use. And so that's just one kind of maybe a bit more abstract one that people think, well, how big of a deal is that? But then there's even other ways of directly how we talk about food and body composition when we're around others who may be heavily influenced by that. So if you think of, this is a big thing within eating disorder research and people with certain eating disorders, of how they counsel not only the person on how to talk to themselves in a more positive way and not to say negative things, but counseling their family and peer groups on language to use or avoid around them, right? How they think about, how they talk about food and body composition. As an example, being careful of a typical thing people might think is a nice thing to say to a woman if they haven't seen them in a while. Oh, you look great. Have you lost weight? Right? Super innocuous, no intent meant behind it. And it's kind of, again, meant in good faith as a potential compliment. But again, that perpetuates this message that, oh, losing weight is good and you look good because you lose weight and otherwise you don't, right? It's this kind of message. So if you hear that over and over again, that becomes something that woman feels they need. They need to be losing weight for people to give them compliment, right? As opposed to saying something that's not based on their weight or that their value or identity is based on a certain part of their appearance. And so subtle things like that can be, again, difficult for us to kind of relearn. So it's just about being, certainly in the presence of some people, being aware of how the language we use influences others, and maybe also our actions. And one example I can give of that is my friend Jacob Skeppis runs a strength facility in Melbourne, Australia. And he has paid a lot of attention to this area because he deals with a lot of bodybuilders and trying to just be acutely aware of people who are primed to develop poor eating behaviors or even disordered eating through that process. And one of the things he was doing a contest prep, I think last year or the year before, maybe 2 years ago. And he has two young daughters. And one of the things he was saying was that he was super cognizant of is that even though he was going to track his food and weigh his food, he did it in secret in a certain place in his house so that his daughters would never even once have the chance to see him weighing a piece of food because of potentially seeing that behavior, what that would now do to them.
Wow.
Starting asking, why is daddy weighing his food, right? Or why is he engaging in certain behaviors? Why is he not eating this certain type of food? So he had to be really careful about how he acted around them because of what they might pick up, even without him purposely realizing it.
Right, because this is a very, being a physique athlete or bodybuilder, it's a very extreme practice.
Sure.
That involves things that, right, you could learn from, but if you did that all the time,
yeah,
could lead to some problems, especially if you have young kids watching you who don't have the understanding, the context,
right,
that this is kind of an extreme sport almost.
Yeah. And so they just see, oh, there's certain foods not to eat. I have to weigh this so I don't eat too much. Fat is bad. Like all these types of messages.
Butt, the striations in my butt muscles to show, right, for this.
And,
right.
And those can go pretty deep because I actually recently did an interview with a intuitive eating counselor based in the UK. And she's currently doing research in nutrition and psychology. And a kind of similar point that she mentioned is how a lot of young women who end up coming to work with her who have had, again, either eating disorders or negative body image or are almost afraid to eat in certain ways, and you kind of dig into some of their early influences, how often they would have grown up in a household where their mother was constantly on different types of diets. And again, not in like had obviously no purpose to try and influence their child, right?
Sure.
Is this something they've been sold? Like how many countless women have been told like different types of diets to try? And if you're growing up and you're seeing the woman you most idolize, and it's just a normal thing to be on a diet all the time and restricting and trying to get slim, and I don't want to eat too much, I don't want to gain weight.
And the emotional issues that she's experiencing and exhibiting as well, right? Sure.
So those things have an influence. So it's just being kind of mindful of what messages we put out through how we speak and what we do. And it's hard to keep thinking of that all the time. So it's not going to happen. But just trying to be more aware of it, I think, is something maybe that could benefit in the fitness industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're not talking about being politically correct as much as being aware of the effect that our language has and just looking at the effect and being like, is that the effect that I want?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I'm, for anyone who knows me, I'm not into being overly politically correct. So that's certainly not the issue. It's more about just, being aware of our language and behaviors, how that may influence people and is there a certain way when we're discussing concepts or ideas that may be more beneficial?
Yeah. No, brilliant stuff. Danny, I feel like we could just keep going, but I want to be respectful of our listeners' time here. I know, working out for that, they're going to have to work out even longer. clean their houses even going. Longer.
Yeah.
We keep going. So really appreciate you, man. So glad that we had a chance to do this before I'm off to Bali. And it's just such a pleasure. It's such a great thing to connect in person after communicating online for a while. And just really a fan of yours, fan of your show, fan of what you're doing.
You,
and it's just awesome to meet you in person. And I'll be, let's make this happen again sometime.
Yeah, this is super cool. Yeah, it was awesome talking. I could talk about this stuff all day long. But it's been great hanging out.
Awesome. And Danny, where should people go? Is it Sigma Nutrition?
Yep. So everything is pretty much on sigmanutrition.com. So that's Sigma nutrition.com. You can find, if people are into podcasts, which I presume they are, just search Sigma Nutrition Radio on any podcast app. And then I'm pretty easy to find on social media. So if they're on Instagram, you can find me Danny Lennon_Sigma. Or just type my name into Twitter or Facebook and you can find me there too.
Excellent. And definitely do that. Danny is one of the people who has one foot in the science-based world and also the other foot in being open to things that a lot of people who are too into the scientism or verificationism aren't going to be into. So I really appreciate you for that. I've learned a lot from you. And if you follow Danny online and listen to his show, you're going to learn a lot as well. So thanks so much, man.
It's been a pleasure.
That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Danny. I hope you felt that energy of us being together, recording this in person for you, because this is not just a job for guys like Danny and I. This is a passion. It's what we live for. It's not a career. It's a privilege. It's a passion. It's just incredible. And I hope that comes through even more when you hear these live interviews. So make sure, if you haven't listened to Danny's show, go to Sigma Nutrition Radio and check out Danny's show, especially if you are a nutrition geek, if you want to get deep into the science. Danny gets the guys on who are doing the research. If you want to get super clear on the things that are proven to work in the area of nutrition, that show is where you want to go, of course, in addition to the Legendary Life Podcast. Now, the last thing I'll say is, if you enjoyed this episode, please show me some love by sharing it. It's the biggest compliment you can give to me. Share it on Instagram or Facebook. Share it with colleagues through email, whatever, wherever and however you share things. It would mean so much to me.
And the last thing, of course, is for the new people. If you have just started listening to this podcast and you want to hear more, make sure you click that subscribe button. So every time one of my episodes goes live, you'll be the first to know. All right, that wraps up this episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you're taking away some actionable points, some things to implement into your life to take your health and experience of life to that next level. And on Friday, I'm going to talk about limiting beliefs, what they are, whether you have them or not, how they hold us back from experiencing more success and achieving more in life, and most importantly, what to do with these limiting beliefs. So if you've ever said, oh, I have a slow metabolism, but you never tested your metabolism. If you said, you know what, I have, it's got to be in my genes. I mean, look at my family. We're all overweight. But you've never tested your genes and you've never really been on a great program to test whether you could overcome your genes with better habits. You're going to want to listen to this program. And we'll talk mostly about fitness, but we'll also share some stories, some examples from other areas of life where these limiting beliefs can pop up. And folks, this may sound like pop psychology, but it's not. This stuff is real. So if you're interested in that, stay tuned for Friday. Have an amazing week, and I will speak to you then. Thank you so much for checking out this episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. If you haven't done so already, please take a minute and leave us a quick rating and review of the show on Apple Podcast by clicking on the subscribe button on your left. Then write a sentence or two saying what you love about our podcast. Please be honest. Tell us what you think, what you'd like to hear, what we can change to make it better. It will support the show and help us to keep delivering life-changing information for you every week.